Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week we have a special New Year's episode with some of our closest colleagues who we have a Sunday Zoom call with every weekend, and they have such expertise. It's George Stevens, a movie director, Broadway producer, Academy Award winner, just knows more about the entertainment business than anybody I know. Roger Altman, who co-founded Evercore, Wall Street powerhouse, and just so interesting and knowledgeable about the economy. And Joe Abramson, the former executive editor of the New York Times and a professor at Harvard and now a professor at Northeastern University. It's going to make for some fascinating conversation. And remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our recent sponsors in our past episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. All right, you out there, we have a real treat for you today. This is a reprise of a call we have every Sunday with some of the smartest people in the universe. Makes Carville and me look good. Everything we learn from them on Sunday, we then try to repeat to you several days later. But anyway, I've introduced them all, and so you know how good they are. I'm going to start with a couple questions. Then James will have some, and then we'll just do what we do on Sundays with our Zoom call. We'll just make it a free-for-all. Everybody can jump in. And no, Jill, you do not have to ask permission. Just jump in, and we'll go from there. Roger, let me start with you, because I know we talk about the economy every Sunday, but Donald Trump says, fueled by his tax cut and tariffs, we're going to have the greatest economy the world has ever seen in 2026. He has some supporters, some analysts. Warren Buffett, on the other hand, is more cautious. He's loading up on cash, suggesting the market correction is due. I know there are differences between the economy and the market, but there are some pessimists too. As you look ahead to 2026, are you closer to the optimist or the pessimist side?
After all, we recently saw the third quarter GDP figure, the figure that measures the growth or lack of growth in the economy in a particular quarter or a year. And that figure was 4.5% growth, which by any objective measure is strong. And it was considerably higher by maybe a full percentage point than the consensus expectation. And it was driven by pretty high levels of spending by both consumers and businesses. So through the third quarter, and that's now a while ago, because these numbers are reported with quite a delay, the economy was resilient or strong. It just was. Now, since that end of the third quarter, we've seen some fragmentary evidence of slowing. The unemployment rate has moved up to 4.6%. The job creation, monthly job creation rate has dwindled down to very low numbers, hardly creating any jobs. But the underpinnings of the economy remain good. And I don't think there's much likelihood, at least in early 2026 or mid-year, of a recession. I think that's not in the cards, at least as I see it. It turns out that the tariffs have had a relatively small effect. Part of that is because the import share of the U.S. economy is quite small. It's only about 11%. So our economy, unlike most other large countries and industrialized countries, is not as dependent on imports as they are. So tariffs on imports don't affect our economy as much because most of the goods we consume are domestically produced. And the tariff rate is, on a given day, about an average, a weighted average 15%. Some say it's higher, some say it's lower, but that's not too far off. And a lot of it has initially been absorbed by retailers or other distributors and not fully passed on to consumers yet. But in any event, it's had a relatively small effect, contrary to a lot of concerns in the early going on the tariffs. So The U.S. economy is in pretty good shape. Markets are very, very, or at least the stock market, very, very high by any historical standard. They've only been higher once in history, which was just at the time of the dot-com boom in the year 2000. And I'm using particularly the idea of the multiples of earnings at which stocks trade. So it's just a matter of time before there's a market correction. Could be a modest one, could be a big one. Nobody's smart enough to know, I certainly am not, whether that's 3 months off or 3 years off. But markets move in cycles, economies move in cycles, and there'll be a correction.
Roger, you're really describing the 2026 with all the uncertainties. And as you said, you're sort of in the middle as one that's not going to be a disaster, certainly, for Donald Trump and the Republicans, but also one that is unlikely to be that boom, that lift that'll turn everything around for them.
That's right. I don't think growth in 2026 is likely to be as high as it was in 2025. But that does remain to be seen. And inflation, which is an important part of the overall equation, is not much changed. There are a lot of different ways to measure inflation, but the PCE deflator, which is widely cited by the Fed, is running at an annual rate of 2.9% right now. Core PCE, so-called, is running at 2.6%. So inflation has not moved down much since President Trump took office, if at all. Although I know he likes to argue the opposite. On the other hand, those numbers aren't that high by long-term standards, those inflation numbers. But we see plenty of evidence that certain middle-income and lower-middle-income earners are struggling. You see that in the retail sales of entities that particularly serve that market. You see that in commentary from fast food CEOs of public companies. And so there's a bit of a tale of two cities in this economy. Upper middle and high earners are doing well and spending well. And lower middle and lower income earners are struggling. I should add that the stock market itself has had a real effect on the economy. Because if you have a 401k or some other like account and there are stocks in it, you're pretty happy with what's going on because the market remains right around an all-time high, very, very high. And so that's the so-called wealth effect where you feel wealthier, even if you're not cashing it in, and you're spending a little more because you feel wealthier. That has also boosted growth.
So we'll see. Let me switch subjects. One of the beautiful things about this call every Sunday is that we go all over the lot with everybody making incredibly smart contributions. George Stevens, you know the entertainment business or the Hollywood version of it as well as anyone. You come from Hollywood royalty. You are Hollywood royalty, an Academy Award recipient. What do you see on that front? Is there a seismic change that's taken place in the movie industry? I know, obviously, not as many people go to the movie theater, but what else do you see?
I think the Netflix, Paramount, Warner Brothers is a perfect metaphor for it. Apart from the financial aspects, there's a very important cultural aspect to it. I mean, the question facing entertainment is, will movie theaters continue to be a main part of the cultural experience? And of course, it's been a vital one for a century. And now you have Paramount with Netflix having the accepted bid at the moment. But Netflix made its reputation on streaming. Ted Sarandos, who runs Netflix, is a very admirable person, but he believes in streaming. There's a quote where his son is a film editor, and Ted was explained to people once that his son can watch Lawrence of Arabia on his iPhone. But to those of us who love the experience of big screens and movie theaters, is a major denial of reality. But Ted has said that he's acquiring Warner Brothers, Netflix, and he intends to make the studio a success and not have it diminished by his preference for streaming. And it comes to, do people, can we trust that? I'm tend to give him credit for, you know, he's a honorable person. Failing that, if Warner Brothers were to cease producing movies, it would be reducing by one the remaining four movie companies, and I think the movie theater business would go away. So that is what we're facing with that situation. And there's another part of it that I think is worth touching base with, and that is the Ellisons, who are the financial, you know, I guess Ellison is the second richest, the father man in the world. And he's now fully backed that investment of billions that he's making. But they compromised CBS in favor of Trump in settling a lawsuit in favor of Trump and bringing in new management to CBS. And just this last week, CBS pulled a story, Barry Weiss, the new appointee, about the migrants who were sent, flown to jail in Latin America. So if Paramount were to succeed, Skydance, whatever it's called, that would mean that CBS is under the control of this Trump-friendly management, and CNN would then belong to the Ellisons. And so that's of concern to people who are interested in the First Amendment.
Sure be a concern to me. James, why don't you jump in and talk to Jill about some of these issues?
Well, yeah, talk to Jill. I'll ask her first because of her expertise, but anybody can weigh in. So there are kind of four stories this month I highlight, and you're the editor, and how do you prioritize them? The Epstein stories, the document changing our entire strategy toward Western Europe, the 60 Minutes Barry Weiss story, the whole CBS News 60 Minutes story, and the whole renaming, particularly the Kennedy Center. You got 2 minutes to put them in order.
Okay. Order of importance, right?
You're putting out the times, whatever.
Okay. Well, the most important is the collapse of the strong relationship we've always had with our Western allies. I mean, that is of crucial importance. And, you know, it leaves you wondering, given the uncertainties of relationship with China and Russia, you know, is the Western alliance, including the U.S., still a bulwark against authoritarianism? And with our president in the White House, that adds an even more urgency to that question. So, you know, I would like to be reading more in coming weeks about that. And, you know, it's related story, and there have been new developments as recently as yesterday of right-wing leadership emerging in Western Europe. So that's number one. There was Epstein and the renaming of the Kennedy Center. And what's number three, James?
It's 60 Minutes CBS hold story, what's happened is CBS.
Yeah,
and 60.
I mean, obviously, I'm biased, but
it's all right.
I've spent my career fighting for free press, and I also write a column for the Boston Globe on Trump and the press. And so that's going to be the second most important story for me, because I think the First Amendment is very much at stake, and that reporters can no longer have confidence at many news organizations, including the so-called Tiffany Network, CBS, that they're good probing stories that try to hold power accountable, which is a big reason why we have the First Amendment. They can have no confidence that their corporate betters and the editors chosen by them are going to have their backs and publish their work. And that, you know, sets in motion a whole cycle of self-censorship, which is very worrisome. I'm confident that certain news organizations that do not have big corporations with lots of other interests, like the Ellisons, like Jeff Bezos, but that places like the New York Times, which are becoming rarer and rarer, which is family owned and, you know, protects its independence as fiercely as any news organization does. I'm confident that, you know, a few will continue to stand up and report and publish truthfully about things like President Trump, his corruption, his cabinet's corruption, his family's corruption. But, you know, I don't really see a whole, you know, and of course, the Wall Street Journal and even the Washington Post, with Bezos not being helpful, is breaking a lot of good stories. And, you know, I could name a few more, obviously the FT and the Guardian. But, you know, it's fewer and fewer, and that is frightening, because to have a truly free press, this country needs a robust press. And with consolidation and with local newspapers especially going out of business, more than a quarter of them are gone at this point over the last decade or so. It's not, you know, the free press is not broadly in the healthiest state that I would hope it would be in and needs to be in, given the you know, will of Donald Trump to control the press and to lob hate bombs in its direction several times a day. You know, I'm hoping that maybe we'll have a few minutes to talk about things like the president calling a reporter on Air Force One piggy. He said quiet piggy, and has, you know, demeaned the looks of other women reporters. And then you see the weakness of the companies that have, you know, lavish multi-million dollar settlements on him. You know, just buckling under the weight of his authority. So, it's tough. And, you know, the fact that we do, you know, from yesterday, have this story about, you know, Barry Weiss, the top editor at CBS, pulling or possibly killing a story about the treatment of immigrants at a awful prison in El Salvador, that's, you know, really discouraging.
James, take it away. So I want to ask...
I'm sorry. And then Epstein, I tie the Kennedy Center because of its symbolism and Epstein, where, you know, but little by little, we're hearing more about the closeness of President Trump's friendship with a convicted child molester.
So I asked George and then Roger, of those four stories, which one would you be most interested in reading? You know, you went to the site and you saw all four. Which one would you click to first?
James, the way I think of it is, which of these things cannot be reversed? And the thing that I always go to when I think of that is are the relationships that the United States has and has had for so long with its traditional Western allies. Right. I don't think we're ever going to be able to return to the conditions that existed pre-Trump, because if in 2028, for example, a Democrat becomes president and says to Canada or Europe or other countries we've traditionally worked with, don't worry, it's over, we're going back to where we were before, it's not credible. So as harsh as some of the wreckage domestically is, like gutting AID or drastically cutting the federal workforce or suspending grants for medical research of all kinds and other scientific research and so forth, I think those can be reversed. The interim damage can't be, but the actual policy can be reversed. I don't think that's the case globally.
Excellent answer. George, you got it?
Well, I was just going to say, but to agree with Roger, that was my thought, that what we're doing with our allies and changing the vibrant and smart relationships we've had that have made us the leader of the world, and I that is going to be hard to reverse. I can talk about the naming of the Kennedy Center, which, you know, you can't compare it to the cruelty that the Trump administration has, with which they've treated immigrants and citizens of this country in this reckless ICE brigade. But the just the to capsulize the or encapsulate the Kennedy Center. At first, it began with Trump lawlessly firing 14 appointed trustees, basically half of the trustees appointed by Biden, and replacing them with cronies. Maria Bartiromo, Susie Wild, Usha Vance. There's the list, and they're totally in his at his beck and call. And they then elected him chairman of the Kennedy Center, with Trump falsely claiming that the Kennedy Center was unstable and falling apart. The Kennedy Center is now falling apart. It was stable when he did this.
Hey, George, can you explain your history with the Kennedy Center?
I created the Kennedy Center Honors in 1978 and produced it for 37 years, and worked with Presidents Carter, Reagan, H.W. Bush, Clinton, W. Bush, and Obama, six presidents. And during that time, not only concerning the honors, but I was very close to what was going on with the Kennedy Center, which presidents appoint trustees for 6 years terms, which with the change of parties means there's always been a balance, and the trustees have always worked together. And not in all of that time did any of the presidents want to voice something, or as Trump now picks the Kennedy Center honorees. So it's a radical change.
It really is, George. And tell me this, can it be reversed? I saw where one of the ex officio members has brought suit. Other people have questioned whether the Kennedy family could bring suit. You've looked at this. What do you think of the prospects?
I think only the Congress can. But later, you know, Trump's name will not remain. And it kind of the part of the poetry of it is that Trump greeted it as a surprise that the board had done this. But the next day, they had all of the gold letters already ready to put up on the wall. But they chose the wrong type font. And so the letters are contrast with Kennedy's, which are much bolder. So I imagine those will be replaced before too long. But I think the primary outrage, if you will, is that a president, the Kennedy Center has stood as the living memorial, as by law from the Congress, to a martyred president. And it has stood beside Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington, those monuments. And for the narcissism of somebody to choose to put his name on the living memorial of a war hero president above his name is just such an unworthy act, you know, that I think that is something that, you know, is really at the heart of the matter.
James, I want you to jump in a lot of things. Let me just ask Roger one more question. You talked about the fraying of the Western Alliance, and it'll be very hard, if not impossible, to put together. I think that's absolutely right, and it caused for great concern. Talk for a minute about who, I mean, they're the greatest competition supposedly is the United States and China. Who's had a better year?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about diplomatically and geopolitically, or you're talking economically. In the first category, I don't think there's any question that China's had a better year. China has, and is really the only major country, has essentially pushed back hard on Trump and gotten the better of him, I think. Because you see right now, we've just agreed to allow China to buy our second most sophisticated semiconductor product, our chip, in exchange for their agreeing to turn around and buy, again, more soybeans for our farmers. It's really symbolic because we're giving them the future and to some degree, focusing on the past in exchange. In addition, we're so preoccupied around the world on what I would call secondary issues. You know, the new national security strategy talking about a return to the Monroe Doctrine, such that the U.S. can do essentially whatever it wants in the Western Hemisphere, and, you know, tilting at windmills on issues like Greenland and to some extent Venezuela, and just leaving so much of the global playing field open for China. But if the question is economic, I think the United States had a better year. China, it really faces some serious long-term economic challenges. You wouldn't know it by today's data because they've continued to double down on a manufacturing slash export strategy, and their trade surplus with the whole world is now exceeds $1 trillion a year. Even though it's lower, a little bit lower than with the United States than it was before. But eventually, that strategy will run out of gas, including over the next 2 or 3 years when Europe starts pushing back hard on it. You look at Germany, and there are serious, really serious risks to the biggest employers in Germany, which typically are the automakers, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and so forth, as Chinese products flood that market, including lower-cost cars. So that long-term, that manufacturing-slash-export model that China has had is not going to be as sustainable as it has been in the past. And they just haven't made the conversion to a serious consumer-driven economy. In addition, they have a very dire demographic outlook. The outlook over the next 50 years is China's population is going to fall dramatically just because of the age, the average age of the population versus the fertility or replacement rate. And you can't grow an economy if your population is falling. The United States faces a much better demographic outlook, although we're not serving it with our current approach to immigration. But I'd say China, at the moment, looks economically fairly healthy, but medium and longer term may not be. So that would be my answer.
James and Jill, weigh in on a lot of this, okay? Let's just go back and forth with anyone. We haven't heard enough from either one of you.
I am the one who picked with our allies as number one. So you have heard from me.
I know. I just love to hear more from you. That's all. Okay. And also from James.
You know, I'm going to just jump back to the press for a minute because there are a couple of things I should have said that I didn't, which is, you know, the White House started out from its first days doing horrible, restrictive things to the press. There was the ridiculous insistence that the Gulf of Mexico be called the Gulf of America. We've almost forgotten that because there have been so many other outrageous things. But, you know, the AP stood up and others did too. And then they tried to punish the AP and say its reporters, you know, would no longer be part of the White House pool, and ended up, you know, supplanting the traditional news organizations that made up that pool with their favorite representatives from the right-wing media. And, you know, it didn't stop, you know, what they did at the Defense Department, taking away the workspaces of the Times reporters and the Journal reporters, and again, replacing them with press organizations that are absolutely going to give them the most favorable treatment possible. And, you know, it's just one thing after another. And the press has, by and large, we can focus on, as I did earlier, on the settlements, which I think are terrible with Trump. But, you know, the press has gotten tougher and is standing up more, I think, which is a good thing and important.
It sure is. James Carville?
So I, every morning, I 6-7 people I call, and today it happened to be we have this thing. And this conversation is about very serious issues, the Western alliance, the Chinese economy, and everything. The only thing that I talked about this morning with people is, can you believe this goddamn Jeffrey Epstein, Larry Nassar story? I mean, that has captured the imagination of people.
James, quickly fill us in. I mean, let me reveal my narrowness. I don't know what it is.
So the story I called the media, I it's almost like it's an Onion story that Epstein 4 days before.
It's a CNN reported story.
All right, okay. 4 days before he, quote, hung himself, unquote, he wrote Larry Nassar saying that he and Larry Nassar and Epstein and Trump shared a proclivity for young women. Now, he writes it from frickin' jail. I don't know if they're censors, that they read the outgoing mail or they read the incoming mail, but that doesn't strike you as almost like an Onion level story of Jeffrey Epstein and Larry Nassar talking about Trump's love of young girl? I don't know. It struck me as quite remarkable.
Larry Nassar being the convicted.
The Michigan State convicted molesting athletes like you couldn't even believe. If you looked at the testimony of these people at sentencing, it'd make you cry. He might be is hideous. The only thing that in his defense is that there were college-aged females. But the idea of these two people communicating from jail about how much they share in common with Trump, because these got to be two of the most hideous human beings of the 21st century. It struck me as a giant fucking deal. I don't know. Maybe I'm
James, I agree. I talked to Mike Tackett, who's also part of that group, and he said the AP was still trying there was some question of verification, and the AP and the Times were still trying to, if the story is true, it's unbelievable.
So CNN's report, I saw it on Mediaite, which I find to be pretty, pretty reliable. But if you just think about it, if that would have been at any kind of time before, you couldn't imagine the earthquake that would have happened. Now it's in the ether somewhere. I don't know,
Well, let me ask Jill a question. This comment is in the ether. I just want to tell you why I think that's the case, and I'm probably wrong, but Jill would have a much better view. So I think the American public have a view of Trump, which is apparently the way the Italian public had a view of Berlusconi.
Yeah.
Which was, we know he is a rogue. We know he hustles after young girls. We know he, is just a reprobate. We all know, all that. That's just the way he is. But we look past that because we like what he's doing from a governing point of view. In other words, eventually, all of Berlusconi's, very vivid personal flaws and faults and habits were just looked past by the Italian public. I think that's what's going on with Trump.
Yeah, I sort of agree. You can't sink much lower than knowing that he raped E. Jean Carroll in a department store dressing room, which, he was in court. The truth of her testimony was certified. And
the judge said, although the actual judgment was assault or something, the judge said it was tantamount to rape,
and right. She claims it was rape, and I see no reason not to believe her.
I mean, James, isn't the notorious former Louisiana governor Edwards an example of this?
First of all, the idea that Trump does all this stuff, but it doesn't bother people because they like other things he does, I issue a strong dissent. I mean, a really strong dissent. He is not playing in Peoria at all. I mean, a 37% approval is not good. A 14-point congressional generic is awful. I actually don't think he's getting away with it.
Well, wait a minute. Let me debate with you. I think he's doing poorly, the way you just said. And that's a fact that you just cited, for other reasons. In other words, he's making the dreadful mistake of trying to tell the American people that conditions at the grocery store in terms of affordability and things like that are better than they think they are. You never win with that, and he's losing with it. But if you asked Trump voters, in 2024, Trump voters, those who voted for him for president, whether subsequent revelations about his personal behavior have surprised them, I think an awful lot of them would say no.
Okay, I'll dissent. He got 49% of the vote in 2024. He's about 37-38%. That's a significant drop. Somebody that voted for Trump was changing their mind.
And I don't think Roger is...
Is disagreeing with that, James. He's just saying it's primarily because he hasn't delivered on his promises on the economy and other things and healthcare.
I'm certainly that has something to do with it, maybe a majority. But the whole thing with the federal government and the shutdown and the all of that stuff, I think at some point makes people at some level horribly uncomfortable. I can't assign it, but I do know that the 2026 election, barring some change that no one sees, is going to be like breathtaking. An incumbent party clocking in at 41 on a, I don't know how good the generic vote is, but I was fooling around with AI. If you got 53, 40, the popular vote was 57-43, how many seats would that produce? It almost broke the computer. I just don't buy that he's getting away with this if people don't care about it. That's my general observation. And I don't think he is, and I think that...
Yeah, well, I would just say, just to take the Berlusconi comparison, which I think in terms of popular perception, I think is valid. But we are facing a situation with a compliant Supreme Court where we are the leader of the free world and our alliances are being dismantled. Our laws, you know, the Texas ruling on voting, and you just whatever the Supreme Court's going to give us, we are really facing an undoing of many aspects of our constitutional government that I argue more dangerous than what was going on in Italy.
I would add the Supreme Court approval at a historic low. All right. People don't like it. The Supreme Court
Roberts having given immunity to Trump, so all of this abuse that he's lawlessness that's going on with the Justice Department, Trump is immune from prosecution for that.
I want to turn to our listener questions in a minute, but Roger or George, someone mentioned the word AI.
James did.
Well, I mean, Roger, pick up on that because you read it's going to be it's going to be far more important and have a far greater impact than the internet, that it's the most significant that's ever happened, which may be the case. And also, you know, we had John Delavolpe on. Young people are horrified by this. They think it's going to wreck their lives. And, some communities are starting to rise up in anger. On the other hand, they've got a lot of very, very wealthy people behind it. So what's your take as to how it's going to evolve over the next year or two?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm a finance person and I'm not a technology person and I'm not an expert at all on the technology side of AI. So my views aren't worth much. But people much, much, much smarter than me, whom I think are objective, and not all of whom have, big investments in this sector, think it's going to be transformative. And an area that I think they're right about, and there are many, many, many other areas they may, this will affect, is healthcare and right. Medicine. And I think you're already starting to see that, and where that when it comes to drug development and drug discovery, and when it comes to certain types of diagnoses, the use of artificial intelligence is not instead of humans, but by humans, is going to be revolutionary. I saw an example the other day that when it comes to radiology, a combination of a human and AI assessment is decidedly more accurate than just a human assessment. In terms, for example, of detecting early signs of cancer. So I'm pretty convinced it's going to be transformative. But, you know, all this fear that may be well-placed, and it's about job displacement and a diminishing value of human labor, it remains to be seen whether that's going to be the case. I know all the fears. They're well chronicled and well written, widely written about. But we just don't know. And throughout history, technologies which had the impact of scaring people, because the idea was, you know, the demand for labor will fall, and so on and so forth, have actually in the long run not had that effect. And the most vivid example is agriculture. In 1900. Something like 25% or more of Americans were employed in agriculture. And today it's 2%. And the labor market in the United States is pretty healthy. So I'm not sure that these fears are well placed, although they could be. But as to whether it's going to be transformative, in many respects, I think it is.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this before we turn to questions?
Yeah, I do, because if De La Volpe said, you know, young people and students are scared to death of it, all I can say is they're using it. They're using it. Students are using AI like crazy, and not just for ill purposes like, you know, writing their papers and things like that, but, you know, it's an incredible research tool. At this point, it does make mistakes. You have to check what it tells you, but I use it. It's amazing what you can get, like, in a matter of seconds, you know, all human thought on something. I use it quite a bit, and I think a lot of people, you know, make use of it, whether it's, you know, when you Google now, you're using AI.
You are, right. Okay. You know, I would point out, Roger, I love your example is such a good one, and it would be so wonderful to have a better diagnosis of cancer. And that also might mean that a radiologist and a couple of technicians lose their jobs.
Could be, but that's not the current wisdom on that subject. Could
it's
be.
Not. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Al, like my son-in-law, who's a surgeon, you know, is very gifted at using robotics, and it's a big leap in surgery. It means, you know, you don't have to, you know, leave huge scars and make bigger incisions than you need to, and it avoids all kinds of medical error because the robots are so precise. So, you know, technology has its, you know, dangers, and we shouldn't, you know, be have rose-colored glasses on about AI. But I think, you know, because it's a sexier story, the amount of attention that the woe is me, the danger, and, you know, I'm not saying there aren't dangers, but they're kind of hyped up, I think, in comparison to, you know, the things that can be achieved through the use of AI.
Well, as soon as James and I understand streaming, we'll try to turn to AI and see if we can get into that. Let me go to we get great questions from our listeners. We really do. We'll take a couple. Then I want to ask each of you one, which I think fits your expertise, as varied as that is. James, let's start with you. John in Chicago says that Ruben Gallego has floated the idea of a war tax on social media and then the rising tensions. He says if you raise taxes on the wealthy, whenever the country goes to war, you're going to see how quickly wars end or aren't started. What do you think of that idea?
Look, Mitt Romney's jumping a gun. He wants to do it right now. I think that one of the things that no one wants to deal with, and it's going to get worse, is the horrific inequality, and particularly in some places, the horrific generational inequality. And, you know, I did that, Andrew, either somebody's going to intervene on capitalism and change things, or it's going to come from the outside. But I see these growth numbers, I see these stock market numbers, and I see it going to the distribution of the fruits of capitalism. It's not very good. And we're doing all this at 4% unemployment. We're going to go to 6.5%. What do you think is going to happen?
Anybody want to weigh in on that?
I'm pretty pessimistic on the willingness of the American people to support the types of at least income tax changes that a country like ours should have. You know, to get to a much more progressive tax system. It constantly amazes me that ideas toward that goal, including from certain moderate Republicans never get traction. I don't mean they don't get traction in policy circles or think tanks. I'm talking about with voters.
I'll dissent on that. Tax and incomes over $450,000 is about popular thing as you can come up with, at least in Poland. Okay? But at any rate, is the
yeah, but James, the problem is the facts. I mean, we've never had a less progressive tax system in the history of the country. I shouldn't say that. The modern history of the country than we do now.
We've seldom had a less popular president of Congress. But anyway, let's go to the next one.
Megan
in Fort Myers, let me take this one. Florida says, why are so many Republicans still afraid to stand up to Trump given his sinking approval ratings? Megan, they have been afraid, some who disagree with what he's doing, and I think the majority of them actually agree with him. But those who don't have been afraid because of examples before, Jeff Flake, Mark Sanford, Liz Cheney. The sense was he could take people out. I think that is really changing. Tom Massey is not afraid of.
Add Stefanik to that.
Yeah. Tom Massey is not afraid of being taken out, and because he won't be. And I think his clout internally has diminished. It's still there among the MAGA people who vote in primaries. But I'll tell you something. As soon as that primary filing season is over, I think you're going to see a number of Republicans change their tune. If they bring up the tax subsidies, extending them for 2 or 3 years on the House floor, you won't just have 4 Republicans. You're more likely to have 40 Republicans who vote for it. Again, anybody have any?
What happens if, you know, the health care subsidies, nothing is done, you know, they stay expired? These lawmakers are facing a wall of condemnation.
Right. That's why I think they're likely to be extended.
I think it'll happen before all the primaries are done.
Well, in January, I think. Roger, you want to weigh in on any of that?
Well, at the moment, I hope this changes, and I could imagine it may, but the conventional wisdom is the House will pass an extension, maybe with certain reforms, of the enhanced subsidies to purchase insurance under Obamacare, and the Senate will not pass it because you would need 13 Republicans to vote for that in order to get the 60-vote level required in the Senate. So the conventional wisdom is the subsidies will not be extended when all is said and done. And that's suicidal, if you ask me. First of all, it's dreadful social policy and public policy. And it's criminally negligent politics. So it's testimony to the problems of the Republican Party, if that's really the outcome here. But the answer to your questioner's question about why more Republicans aren't standing up to Trump, and we'll see if that changes, you know, is a question that I asked of Hakeem Jeffries about 2 months ago, and I asked him how many races in the House, remember there were 435 House members, did he expect to be really competitive in 2026? And he said 40, which means that 395 races out of 435 are seen, at least by him, as not competitive. And so the Republicans in those non-competitive races don't have anything to worry about by definition.
I think they're probably more than that, but no, I think that's...
That was his answer, Al.
No. Let me go. You know, we have some great listeners across the pond. And George Stevens, Mark in County Durham, England, says a couple weeks ago on this show, we mentioned the film Nuremberg. He went to see it. He thoroughly enjoyed it. But he said, I'd like your recommendation. Give me some other movies and other films I can go see that might not have occurred. And if you have any ideas for books, too. So, George Stevens, you are our expert here. What movies can we tell Mark to go to that are showing over in the UK?
Well, I imagine it's only an accident. The film by the Iranian director that won the prize at Cannes and is going to probably win the Oscar for Best International Film. That's a wonderful experience.
What's that film again, George?
Recommend.
What is that film?
It, 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 It's only an accident.
Okay.
That has another title in Europe, but that it's Iranian, and that would be my top recommendation.
Anybody else want to recommend anything or a new
George,
book?
Have you seen the film Sentimental Value?
I've not, but I understand it's worth watching.
Well, I saw it this past weekend, and I'm not knowledgeable about film criticism, but I thought it was wonderful.
If he liked Nuremberg, it's not new, but one of the best movies I've ever seen is a movie called Conspiracy with Stanley Tucci and Kenneth Branagh. That's one of the, I think, five best movies I've ever seen. And particularly if your interest lies in a movie like Nuremberg.
For books and a novel, Ian McEwan's new book, What We Know, is fabulous. And he is a wonderful writer.
Jill Mo in Austin, Texas, says that TV heads and newspapers used to always remind viewers and listeners and readers that our fearful leader is a convicted felon. I never hear that anymore. Why not?
There's so much more to say about him. That's terrible. He's been a convicted felon for quite a while now. But, you know, I think Mo is right. It should be, you know, you should be able to find it in a lead story, once a week, I think. And I haven't really noticed its disappearance. But, you know, I think that part of the answer, if it has disappeared, is that, you know, he's president now, been president a year, and, you know, the normal rules of journalism would be not to, after naming the president, have a clause, a convicted felon. But you know, I have said in my columns all year that this is not a normal presidency. It's built on lies, and it's a fact that he's a convicted felon. So I'm comfortable seeing it as often as it should be either said or published.
This is on the subject of the media, not this one, but I want to just weigh in one thing on the Barry Weiss CBS story. When she killed the story, she told them that they ought to call. She gave them Stephen Miller and Tom Holman's phone numbers. This was the last minute. And it does raise the question, has she talked about the story to them? Which, if that's the case, Jill, that's even more egregious than anything else. I mean, if she's talking about CBS stories.
There's something on the record about that. And she asked the CBS on that story, asked for comments from HHS and the White House, and they refused to comment, which effectively, because they did not, had refused to comment, then their boss sees that they have not commented. It gives the White House the capability of spiking the story by not commenting.
Right, it sure does. And then Weiss went on to say, call Stephen Miller, here's his phone number. Call Tom Holman, here's his phone number. So the whole thing is just kind of rotten, but that's a...
I'm with you.
Roger... someone named Bree, a man from Belleville, Illinois, because he gives his wife credit on this, says, we used to have a vigorous antitrust enforcement going back to Standard Oil. Why are Amazon, Google, and the networks allowed to monopolize now? Isn't that really a double standard?
That's a very good question. For better or worse, a long-running antitrust suit against Google was recently, this is in the last 2 or 3 months, resolved in Google's favor in court. By the way, not at the Supreme Court, but by a lower court that handles antitrust cases. And there are pending antitrust cases against Amazon, among others. By the way, antitrust efforts are efforts to force Meta to sell either or both of Instagram and WhatsApp have also failed on antitrust grounds.
But Meta had to restructure.
Right. Anyway, historically, it's proved hard. Remember, the Standard Oil example was 1905, I think.
Right, right. But there was AT&T.
Yeah, but it's proved hard. And
I mean, Roger, a hopeful thing is that the antitrust chief in the Justice Department, Gail Brewer, may actually be the only really good lawyer in the Justice Department. She's a Trump appointee, but she's very highly thought of. And
yeah,
she has tried to stand up when the White House has quashed some antitrust investigations.
I agree. All I'm really trying to say is that historically,
it's tough.
Whether you had Democratic or Republican administrations, it's proved hard. Yes, there are some great big examples historically, like the AT&T breakup, like Standard Oil, but there aren't many of them.
Our friend John in Gurnee, Illinois. James and I are going to visit Gurnee, Illinois one of these days because John writes almost every week. Says, for the first time in history, 28% of elected state governors will be women. Is that going to lead to a woman president, or is the bar too high? You know, who is it? Nancy Pelosi and Michelle Obama and others are weighing in on this. I don't think the bar is too high. I think just the fact is that neither Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris ran a very good campaign. And I think I think the bar is certainly not as high as it was for blacks prior to 2008. And a good woman candidate will win. I don't know who that is. I don't know when it will be. But I don't think it's the impediment that that some suggest. But immediately, let me go to Joe Abramson and then James Carville on that.
Go to James.
James.
I agree with Al 100%. And we're going to not stop, nor should we, stop nominating women candidates. And by the way, that's a theory I hear much more from women than I hear from men. Now, not to anecdotal evidence, but I can assure you, I hear women tell me country's not going to vote for a woman president. I hear that much more from females than I do from males.
Yeah.
And I don't buy it.
Well, James, you know, you used to hear that a lot from blacks prior to Obama, too. They'll never vote for a black president.
Well, you heard it from me.
No.
I would have said, you'd have asked me in 2005. I said, you got to be kidding me. I agree with you. Hillary actually won the popular vote by more than a little bit. So somebody voted for her. And Harris had a campaign strategy that she was not going to be for change when 72% of people wanted change. It's a miracle she came as close as she did. If you just look at what she was saying.
She also had a short time to campaign.
No, she spent $2 billion and didn't get a single vote on election day. She wasn't getting on Labor Day. More time would have done her. I don't think it done it. I don't think it's worth 10 votes. I'm pretty, you know, I think one person is the colossus over the 2024 election, and that person is Joe Biden. I'm sorry. And you blame people for not going to vote for a woman. You can blame people for, you know, overlooking all of Trump's foibles. You can blame people for a lot, but nobody.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I think, Al, like, rather than seeing it as, will we ever have a woman president, that this anti-DEI campaign that's been so shrill, and I think in certain institutions unfounded, has actually resulted in fewer women reaching CEO, reaching the C-suite, or being on corporate boards. So that's just a fact.
I got to tell you, the Defense Department, there was a provision where vendors in Army mess halls that were blind got a coveted place at the front to help them set up. They did away with that and said it was damaging troop morale that blind vendors on military bases got a closer position to it. That's a fact. No, I would have thought blind vendors
would be
You get a lot of New York, big high buildings. Roger knows this. They have blind, they give them the sundry shop at the bottom of the building. But when blind vendors become caught up in a DEI controversy,
it's crazy.
Well, I'll tell you, one of my heroes, although I've never met her in this, is Mackenzie Scott, who is countering in every way possible with her considerable resources, the anti-DEI stuff.
Yeah.
But I wish there were more of her.
Costco.
George, before we move on to our final question, anything?
No, I'm rather stimulated. I'm hoping to get, what is it, I wrote it down here. Yeah, I want a PCE deflator for Christmas.
Okay. George, it's so small that you would have trouble finding it.
Okay.
It's just a number, a little number.
All right, our final question, James, to you, comes from Mike in Louisville, Kentucky, who says, if corruption is the primary theme for Democrats in 2026, and then particularly in 2028, is it enough to simply say corruption will be identified and pursued? Does there need to be a rough blueprint and guarantees of prosecutions?
Well, thank you, my friend from Louisville. You have to tie that the corruption is hurting you, okay? That all of this is going on, and there are favored people that get everything, and it's corrupt, and you get nothing. And that it is endemic of a problem where a few people enjoy all of the spoils. And as long as there's corruption, that is going to continue to happen. So in addition to being against the law and being immoral, it's actually hurting you. It's not just a couple of state legislators passing money around in a brown paper bag. It's leading to policies and decisions that are hurting voters in ways that we couldn't imagine. That's how you make it a big issue.
I was just going to say, that reminds us that the head of ICE, who took $50,000 in a paper bag or some kind of a bag from that he has refused to comment. The Justice Department has paid no attention. And it just shows how these outrages, about what outrages us one week is still true 20 weeks later, and nothing has happened.
George, on a final note, you'll be interested to know this. I guess over the last hour, a Democratic member of Congress sued the Kennedy Center Board of Trustees, right, arguing that changing the name of the Kennedy Center is illegal given the statute that created it, and so she's suing on behalf of the Congress.
Good.
She's an ex officio member, and we'll see if that works. Listen, this has been great. We want to wish everybody out there a happy 2026. And you know, when pollsters ask the question, "Is the country moving in the right direction, or is it off in the wrong track?" and they don't say it's about economics or it's about foreign policy. It's just a general feeling. So as a general feeling, will 2026 be better than 2025? Jill?
Yes.
Roger?
No.
George?
I'm afraid not. As long as Trump maintains his power and his recklessness,
look forward to November's in 2026. Okay. Yeah.
James?
A resounding no till November, and then a resounding.
Yeah, but then.
That's
so you're a no for five, I'm 6
no
of the year, and then a
through,
yes
through the election, and then a passionate no through the election, and a passionate yes after the election. And when they get, well, and I think we're going to win the Senate, and I don't think it's going to be 51-49.
Well, I certainly agree with you post-November. I think it's going to be better those first 10 months because I think Trump is starting to weaken, and I think Republicans are starting to get nervous. And I think people are catching on to his act. But listen, I hope every one of you has a wonderful 2026. As do I wish the same for all of our listeners. This has been a fun hour. We appreciate your time. And this is almost as good as Sunday afternoons, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. See you. Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our recent sponsors and our past episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another program as we continue our War Room planning. And the happiest of 2026 to all of you out there. It's going to be a better year.